Case number 14-7048 et al. Henry, Deborah M. Stevenson, Eugene Smith, and Deborah M. Stevenson, appellants versus First American Title Insurance Company et al. Mr. Smith for the appellants, Mr. Stedman for the appellees.
Good morning. Eugene Smith, pro se, on behalf of the appellants. Your Honors, this case may be viewed as a remnant of the recent financial crisis. However, this case comes down to fundamental issues of law. Summary judgment in favor of the plaintiffs should not be granted here for several reasons. First reason, standing issue. Second reason, equitable subrogation does not apply in this case. And third, the defenses that were raised below are not affirmative defenses, but rather statutes designed to protect the public, which may not be waived. With respect to standing issue, this case was brought by First American Insurance Company in 2007. Nowhere in the pleadings did the insurance company indicate an injury in fact, which is required by the Supreme Court case in Lujan. You're required to meet two factors, constitutional standing as well as prudential standing. The other plaintiffs weren't joined in the case until 2008. So this case proceeded only with First American. Nowhere in the pleadings did they allege an injury in fact. There's no evidence of an injury in fact. In fact, this court has held in Spann v. Colonial that litigation costs may not be considered as a factor in determining an injury in fact. In 2008, the other plaintiffs were allowed to join the case. They never presented a note, the Fremont note in this case. All notes that were presented prior to the sudden appearance of the note in October 2008 did not bear any endorsement, either specially or in blank. Given that the First American did not meet the standards of constitutional standing, the case should have ended there. They should not have been allowed to substitute in other parties to create jurisdiction for this court.
If we do get to the next issue, your point there is that you didn't sign the key document.
Exactly, Your Honor. I was, my mother asked me to attend the settlement for the refinance. I looked over the papers. I decided that this was not a good idea. So I tried to persuade my mom, but she was persuaded by, the mortgage broker at the time that this was a good idea. She would be able to, refinance at a lower rate later. I decided that I didn't want any part in this. I'm a joint tenant on the property. I decided to leave. Since my mother, regrettably didn't listen to me at the time, I did not sign any of the documents. The court acknowledged that Fremont knew at the time that I did not intend to transfer my interest in the property. I did not intend to sign any of the documents, yet and still they went through with the refinance, and almost a year later, they approached me to say that you need to sign these documents. I said, I'm not signing these documents. The point with respect to equitable subrogation, the plaintiffs wish to apply the doctrine in a way that's never been applied before. The doctrine is typically applied in the context of a refinance when there are competing liens on the property. Here, there's no competing liens on the property. Even the cases that the plaintiffs rely on indicate that the doctrine should not be applied in those instances where there's no competing liens. In Eastern's case, they pointed out that the plaintiffs rely on in the restatement of property, which the plaintiffs rely on. In comment A there, it says that the doctrine does not apply in instances where there's no competing liens.
Should it be the case that there is a lien on half the value of the property now, or no lien?
It should be the case.
Your mother did sign the documents, even though you did not, right?
I'm sorry?
Your mother did sign the documents, right?
My mother did sign the documents, yes. Your Honor. We would argue that, based on our defenses, one of which is that the loan was illegal from the beginning.
Well, forget about that for a moment, just as far as the state of the title. Assume that you fail on that defense. Should there be a lien on half the value of the property or no lien?
I think that no lien on the property.
Why would there not be a lien valid as against your mother's
interest? Your Honor, assuming that our defenses aren't appropriate in this case, then there possibly should be a lien on one half of the interest, but I don't think that that's the doctrine of equitable subrogation. Your Honor, furthermore, the plaintiffs are requesting that the court ignore longstanding law in the District of Columbia. The bankruptcy court noted that neither Eastern's Savings Bank nor Burgoon applied or decided the issue of what should happen in a case of actual knowledge. That is not disputed here. When there's an issue of common law that's undecided, the District of Columbia usually looks to Maryland for...
Usually, but not always. And there's case law that says they would look...
Not always.
...to the restatement here, right? And if they look to the restatement here, you lose on this point.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how are we supposed to decide whether we should look to the common law of Maryland or the restatement? How are we to know which to do?
Well, the case law in D.C. In Johnson v. Fairfax, the court stated in a long line of cases that D.C. isn't required, but they said that special consideration should be given to Maryland law. Here, even if you would decide to, assuming that you were persuaded that the restatement would apply, which is not the majority approach when dealing with actual knowledge. Even in the Washington...
No, but the D.C. Court of Appeals has looked to the restatement before.
Right.
And in this case, that's what we're supposed to imagine what they would be doing, right?
Exactly. The court did look to the restatement in the Eastern Savings Bank case, but, the court said that issue, whether actual knowledge would bar the application of the doctrine wouldn't be decided here.
No, that's right. That would decide. But isn't it instructive that they look to the restatement?
I think that, there are three considerations, and one of them is the restatement that the D.C. court could look at. Even assuming that the court was to look at that, back to what the restatement says, is that when there is no competing lien, then the doctrine should apply. Even the case that the plaintiff cite in Bankers, Bank of America v. Preston, they look to the Washington Supreme Court. Even the Washington Supreme Court and Kim v. Lee stated that when there's a negligent insurance company involved, that the doctrine would not apply. Here we have an insurance company trying to neglect their contractual obligations here and ask the court to apply the doctrine in a way that would be unprecedented.
I don't remember you asking for rebuttal time, but I bet you want
2 minutes,
some.
Yes.
Okay, so we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
please the Court. Mike Stebno on behalf of the appellees.
Could you address the point opposing counsel made on equitable subrogation about which law applies here, common law of Maryland, restatement, and if restatement, which I presume you're going to say, how do you respond to the opponent's point that the restatement doesn't really apply here because we don't have competing lien holders? If you could address that.
I will, Your Honor, absolutely. First, clearly I'm going to argue that the Maryland law, as urged by Mr. Smith, does not apply. I also think he misinterprets the Maryland law, and I'll talk about that in a brief moment. But in both Burgoon, when that was the highest court for the state court equivalent in the District of Columbia, and in Eastern Savings, reaffirming and embracing the logic in Burgoon, the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia said that they canvassed all of the various interpretations of the equitable lien, equitable subrogation doctrines in this country and said, very consciously, we choose the most liberal approach of all of these. The sort of equitable assignee test embraced by Eastern Market was, and I would hand cite it in the brief, but where the rights of innocent third persons have not intervened, the release will not prevent the person making the payment from becoming an equitable assignee. In other words, it's a balancing of equities test like any other equitable lien question. So I would very much disagree with the idea that what the various plaintiffs sought below on behalf of HSBC Bank is the successor in interest to the deed of trust at issue. The notion that asking for the declaration of an equitable lien under these circumstances is unprecedented.
It is a bit, at least passing, strange that I know you don't have the kind of formal closing we want to have, but they let this thing close without having the signature of a joint tenant on the property.
There can be no argument that had the settlement agent done everything they were supposed to do, we wouldn't be standing here today. It's absolutely true. And so that is why we're talking about an equity claim rather than something else, because the question becomes, under these circumstances, what should happen?
Now, well, back to your question. Mr. Smith's the one who chose not to sign it, yet Mr. Smith's the one who's going to have to lose his interest.
I respect
if your position's correct.
I disagree, and this is why. This is why what the bankruptcy court below and then the district court after that had no problem seeing. There is no dispute in this case that Mrs. Stevenson and Mr. Smith acquired the property in the first place with a purchase money loan in her name for which both of them signed a deed of trust. He was a grantor on that first deed of trust. I would argue a little clever by half in the briefing below and here when they say Mr. Smith was never an obligor under the promissory notes, that's true, but there is no doubt that he did sign as a grantor on the purchase money deed of trust by which they got their property. There was a refinance loan sometime later conducted by Wells Fargo. There's also no dispute at all that at that refinance loan, which paid off the first loan, Mr. Smith again signed as a co-grantor. Here, on the third loan, the second refinance loan, again, my client's predecessor, Fremont, paid off the purchase money loan for which Mr. Smith had signed a deed of trust. It would be no different functionally if my client had come in and paid Wells Fargo directly and asked for an assignment. They would have gotten it. There would have been no questions asked. The only remaining issue as to any change in status for Mr. Smith here was addressed below. And the court said, as a matter of equity, the only real difference between Mr. Smith being a grantor on that prior deed of trust and Mr. Smith being subject to the equitable lien imposed now would be a potential difference in interest rates. And so they consciously ordered below the same interest rate that the loan was subject to under the Wells Fargo lien. So in terms of where Mr. Smith is today, he's exactly where he was when he willingly signed the last deed of trust that was paid off. And again, there's no dispute at all in this case that my clients paid that off. There is talk about a rescission attempt by Ms. Stevenson. What's never really addressed in any of the briefing by the appellants in this case is that they took the money and they've never given it back. The reality is that $118,000 did go to pay off a loan that she did take out, that Mr. Smith did co-sign for on a deed of trust. And that's just the fact of it. So to reach any conclusion other than that the lien attaches to the property is to conclude that at least Mr. Smith, and possibly Ms. Stevenson, we would say no, but at least Mr. Smith gets the windfall of a payoff, a loan for which he had pledged an interest for no reason other than that a settlement agent clearly did something wrong. And there's no dispute that a mistake was made there. But, again, what Burgoon and what Eastern Savings looked at and consciously embraced was a notion that where there was no just or equitable reason to punish that lender, then they shouldn't be punished. And here is a case where, again, Mr. Smith makes a number of arguments.
But there's two approaches here, right? The majority approach and the restatement approach.
Here, that is true. That is certainly true and acknowledged.
On the majority approach, you would lose.
I don't know that we do, Your Honor, because in the majority approach, again, those cases don't deal necessarily with the fact pattern and the issues presented in this case. In Mr. Smith,
but it's the actual the actual knowledge is the key.
The actual knowledge is an issue, but the actual knowledge in those sort of majority rule cases, again, pertains to intervening lien holders in circumstances where, well, again, intervening lien holders, mm-hmm. and I would submit to this court, as we did below, Mr. Smith analogizes himself to an intervening lien holder, but he's not really, right? He was someone, yes, the settlement company, and by default, then the lender were certainly aware of Mr. Smith, but his interest was on record as an owner subject to a purchase money loan for which he granted an interest. I don't think he falls in the same category as at least some of those majority rule cases. I would point out, and this circles back to your first question, Judge Griffith, the G.E. Levinson case relied upon by the appellants, the Maryland case, wholly factually distinguishable. That case does talk about actual knowledge, but it also talks about actual knowledge within the context of a judicially monitored foreclosure process in the state of Maryland. So
you are saying that you would prevail even under the Maryland rule, is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the case cited by the appellants doesn't address this issue. What I would also point out is as far as...
So what would happen if the restatement were not out there and we were following the Maryland or majority rule?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Other than to say again that I don't know this. I believe this case, under general equitable principles, establishes what... that we were entitled to the relief granted below. I did want to circle around quickly to the Maryland question.
Just on Mr. Smith's, your position treats Mr. Smith as if he had signed when he didn't sign.
I suppose functionally, with the caveat that the Mr. Smith's status has been shaped carefully by a court considering the equities, I would say, subject to that caveat, that's true.
What did the caveat mean?
Well, again, the caveat meaning that the only, as I said before, the only real difference between where Mr. Smith was then and where he is now is that it's couched in terms of an equitable lien rather than a deed of trust interest, because he had certainly promised there's no dispute that he had promised Wells Fargo on that.
Right, on that one, but that's not the one. I mean, you've termed it a windfall, but it seems like another way to look at it as getting the benefit of your bargain or lack thereof by not signing something and therefore not being obligated. I mean, I would assume your clients will hammer anyone who signs a document and force them to live up to their obligations. Here, someone does not sign a document and is still being forced to act as if he did sign the document.
I agree that that is true, but again, Your Honor, I do think it would amount to a windfall for Mr. Smith.
He did sign the original
note. He signed the original deed of trust.
But that note's been paid off.
Yes, it has. By my client's
money. Your client didn't get an obligation from Mr. Smith.
They did not. No.
But I'm not sure why it's equitable to impose the benefit of your bargain on somebody who didn't enter the bargain.
Well, Your Honor, again, I can only go back to in balancing these equities, the reality of it is the money that was expended in a refinance loan by HSBC through its predecessor in interest did pay off the loan for which Mr. Smith had secured
his property. Why isn't it the case, as your opposing counsel has suggested on the brief, that you're a volunteer, as to Mr. Smith? He didn't ask you to pay off his loan. You paid off his loan without him asking you to.
We addressed that in the brief, Your Honor, and I think...
I know it, but not very successfully.
Well, I'm sorry to hear
tell
that.
Tell me again why you're not a volunteer as to Mr. Smith's obligation.
Well...
You addressed it in the brief. Try it again.
Again, Your Honor, because certainly it would sort of defy logic to think that a lender would go out and expend $118,000 in a refinance
Except loan. That we know they did.
We know they did. We know that
we
it was
know
an error.
They did it without him signing the documents, and it appears from the record they knew he didn't sign.
Why do you say it was an error? He was there. He spoke up. They heard him and said...
No, to be clear, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that there was...
Yeah, you call it a mistake, but why? It was a mistake from your vantage point.
Yes.
It wasn't a mistake from his vantage point. It was a hard bargain, and he won. Are we in the business of fixing up bad negotiating?
I don't know that I would, by banks? Well, I don't know that I would characterize it thusly, Your Honor. There was a settlement agent in the room, certainly not Fremont Bank, and yes, that settlement agent very clearly did make a mistake.
You used the word agent, which is correct. Fremont was in that room through that agent.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand that point. I did want to circle on very briefly to the question about the Maryland common law.
The consideration for the... what they did in paying off, they just was the interest, Ms. Stevenson's interest. I mean, that's the problem. They assumed something was going to happen that didn't end up happening, right? That the Mr. Smith's interest was going to be transferred. I think that was the assumption, at least as the briefs and the submissions below portray it.
Correct.
That didn't end up happening. And then the question is whether the document is treated as if he signed it when he didn't sign it.
Well,
I realize I'm saying the same thing, and you've responded to it, but it just strikes me that if the positions were reversed here, there'd be no mercy.
Well, Your Honor, in part, I suppose I'd respond to that by pointing out that I realize I'm going well over my time.
That's fine.
I apologize.
Yeah. No, we're asking you questions. The red light only works for you. It doesn't work for us.
Very good. Thank you, Your Honor. I think that was... a reality wrestled with by the courts below, when they did strike our first claim, the first count of the two-count complaint addressed sort of an attempt to reform the deed of trust to include Mr. Mm-hmm. Smith's signature. And that's, again, why the count that survived was the equity count. The court looked at it and said, he didn't sign it. There's no excuse to that. We can't compel him to sign it. But looking at these tests as laid out in the governing case law in the district, we think the equities favor the imposition of a lien under the set conditions included in the order.
And why do you think the D.C. Court of Appeals would follow the restatement rule and not the Maryland common law?
Two reasons. One, because the D.C. Court of Appeals has made clear in each of the two governing cases that the most liberal of the possible standards is the one embraced in this jurisdiction. The second is the Maryland case...
Well, they haven't addressed this issue specifically.
Not
right?
This specific issue, no, but... As a doctrine, they've said we take the broadest of the possible test. The other reason...
Should we send it to them and have them tell us what they would do? Or is it so clear what they would do in your mind?
I think the latter, Your Honor. I think that the imposition of the lien under these circumstances was clear, yes. But the second point I'd mention is this GE v. Levinson case, which I've already attempted to distinguish in any event, is a case that was rendered well into the late 20th century. The notion that D.C. follows Maryland common law is true up into the incorporation of the District of Columbia because the common law was carved out of Maryland. G.E. v. Levinson is obviously a case well after the charter for D.C., and so it's not binding, and to the extent it could be viewed as persuasive, I point out again that it is contrary, or at least in tone and I think broad brushstrokes, contradicted by Eastern Market. So.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We have
thank you. Everyone.
Mr. Smith, 2 minutes to rebut. Nothing new, just rebuttal for what you heard.
With respect to the plaintiff's issue with regard to controlling precedents here and the District of Columbia, they point to Burgoon and the quote-unquote liberal approach. The Burgoon court in that decision warned against extending the liberal approach too much. Quote, for while the liberalization of the law by equity was and is necessary and wholesome, it is not to be gainsaid that it is the price of uncertainty of decision which should be extended with great caution. Moreover, the relief from their folly of those who in respect of contemplated property transactions do not consult available lien records seem more the task of school than of the court. There, it suggests that the Burgoon court would, in this day and age, follow the Maryland approach, which states that actual knowledge would bar the application. The plaintiffs point to the equities here. The equities aren't the only points that they have to make to establish equitable subrogation here. They have to, first of all, show that there are competing liens on the property, which is not. The defendants aren't requesting a windfall here. What the defendants are saying is that the equities do not favor the plaintiffs here. Even in the Washington Supreme Court case in Kim v. Lee, that the jurisdiction which the plaintiffs rely on, the court there said that the insurance company should not be relieved from their obligation, from contractual obligation. And we think that that should control the issue here.
Great.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.